Okay, so our next presentation is on Renaissance Music in the Digital Domain, MEI, and the Dynamic Scholarly Text. And we have David Fiala from Université François Rabelais in Tours, and Richard Friedman from Haverford College. And these are joining us here on the screen. And when he talks, it sounds like God.
Thank you, and thank you very much for all this program and for inviting us to present our results.
So we've been speaking of text until now, and now we'll speak about music. Well, music, digital study of music, and more precisely, music notation in that case, because, of course, music is mostly sound. But we are working on music notation, and music notation is still at an early stage in the history of digital humanities. I mean, we don't have the kind of corpora you have, and we don't have tools such as you have. But so we're on our way, working with on MEI, which is a child of TEI. So it's smaller, but it's growing, and we're working with that. We decided to work on a very specific genre, and I'll do the presentation of this musical genre, which has specific characteristics which are linked to what we all spoke about: intertextuality, citation, quotation, and links between humanistic objects. So this is what we will be presenting. First, a short introduction by myself, then what we studied, who participated, how we collaborated, and further explanation. Well, of course, citation and allusiveness in music is a very common practice, as it is in literature and other practices, cultural practices. We can think of many, many examples, cover songs, even rap. I mean, rap music is about samples. So it's even a practice, of course, jazz, and, well, all music, in fact. In the Renaissance, we have a very peculiar genre, which is dealing exclusively with that. What is that genre? It's a genre called imitation mass. And so you have it on the right here. What is the idea? A composer composed a song, a motet. So the motet is a piece in Latin, on Latin text, on Italian poetry, whatever, and which is a short piece, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And then some months, years after that, another or the same composer decided to write a mass in five different sections, which are part of the liturgy, of course, and each of the section is longer than the modal. So, and doing this, what is interesting in that is that this construction this elaboration of the mass is quite a strict procedure, and we'll explain that. But first, how do they do this? Of course, it's not about quoting again and again the model. It's about recombining every material from the model and recreating a new music that you would recognize but not be so sure. That's the idea. Here is an example, a short example from next door. So you are here. Rue de la Serpente, and here. Here is Notre Dame. A printer in 1548 printed a song. And 20 years later, another printer printed the mass. And we'll just have a look at this example, which is very short, and which will allow you to hear a little bit of music. Here are the sources. I won't tell much about this. Of course, we have to edit all this. As I said, we don't have these corpora already accessible, so we have to produce the editions, both of the model and of the mass. And here are the audio example. So on the left you have the text of the model, and as you see, the text of the model is bawdy. So what does it say? It says, well, oh, nice little brown-haired girl, and you can imagine the rest, or read the French. Hope it'll work. So at some point it was probably quite a famous song, and then 20 years later a composer decided to write a mass on that song, no matter of the body text, etc. So that was the first part of the song. Then Christa is on tutenu, je crois.
That's the tutenu on my
And the last section probably is again on the beginning. No. It's on this. So, stop it. Yeah. So how does this work, and why is this interesting? Well, there are many questions that can be asked, of course, on such objects. This genre is not of the most respected genre of the history of music. I mean, it's about reconfiguration, but in fact, it's a very interesting genre. We have several questions to ask. The most interesting thing for us is we're in a composer's workshop. Because, in fact, we see the composer, what we understand what the composer sees in the model and what he wants to do with it. And he sees all the potential configurations that are possible. So this is the most interesting thing. It's about language, it's about counterpoint, which is this procedure of this way of composing. Then it's about, of course, also semantics, how meaning changes, and it's also about cultural practices, about the audience. what's the point? I mean, to have a mass and a body song. Of course, all the masses are not on body songs. You have very religious motets and pieces, but they are also on that kind of songs. And there is many questions that can be answered. Now, why digital? I'll think I have to go quick on that. Music is number made audible. I'm not sure it's clear for everyone, but well, an octave is half of the upper note. Is half the frequency of the lower note, and they were dealing all the time with that kind of questions, and that was their view of music also. I mean, music is number made audible is a very frequent quote in music theory and in any writing about music until the 17th century. Then music encoding music notation is encoding. It's already a code, of course. And now we have this MEI, but well, it's a symbolic representation of sound, which leaves aside many parameters, but keeps some of the parameters which are interesting for a composer. Then counterpoint is combination. You see Fugue by Jean-Sébastien Bach here. And this is the language on which we are working. It's counterpoint. Well, and so imitation of counterpoint is recombination, since the first work was already a combination of small chunks of music. What we studied, we created our aim. Was to work on the relationships, how the composer elaborates the new music starting from the model. So we created a big database of relationships between model and mass. Perhaps I can go further. Here is an example. Do I try it live? Yes, it appears here. It loads the score. So this is just to show an example live on the website. This has been selected by an analyst, a human student of us, and he or she saw that this motif had been transformed in the mass. I can explain very quickly, but you can see, or perhaps we can. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure we need to listen to that. You can have a look even not reading music. You'll see that the same ID reappears exactly in the mass, but it has been shifted. The first two notes are shifted. Here you have a long D, and then. Well, I won't explain the detail. You can have a look. And in fact, it's a very small shift, but it's a calculation. It has to work. Well, it's not that easy to do. Using the same motif, but transforming, just shifting one bar, just inverting the model, and that kind of things. And so we build ways of explaining and sharing our analysis of these works. So this was an example of relationships, and so we have this database of relationships. This database is not that big. I already said the corpus is not that huge. The mass, the settings of the mass is of course a very frequent musical piece. We have 40,000 examples, but for the imitation mass, the overall corpus is between 500 to 800. So the pieces of 25 to 30 minutes. We decided. Not to try to build a huge corpus. We decided to have only 20 masses, which is not that much, which makes 10 hours of music. 20 masses, 20 models. But what we were interested in was to trace in very detail the way the model was transformed in the mass, and to have a double check by the expert this analysis. So we had three main themes. Josquin, who is the earlier figure, was very often used as a model over a century. Mass at the mid-century, you heard an example. Self-reflections, the way composers work on their own works, which is a special case, of course. And the overall aim was to produce the database. We were trying to understand how musical style change and that kind of other questions. Here we already mentioned the patterns of competition and homage between composers. Of course, the choice of the model says something of what you think of the composer, of what he's doing, the play with audience, and the cultural meaning. I already mentioned that. And then we also thought that this would be a good test for digital tools in music. What kind of collaboration digital tools could provide us on those questions, which are precise questions. Perhaps I leave you the word, Richard. Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, that's fine. And I'll share the screen just so that you appear.
I can see it here in any case, so it's easier.
Yeah, but that way we see you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So.
Do you want me to pick up here? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, to say a few things about who participated, as you can see, it's an international team of scholars and students. So we're both transatlantic and also intergenerational. You can see some photos of us at work at Tour. There's David at work with students from Montreal. One happens to be Italian, the other is actually American. So it's a very international team. There were a variety of groups and functions. We had an editorial technical team. We had a variety of scholars from many different institutions. You can pass to the next slide. So these are the leaders, experts in the domain who helped us develop methodologies and define the corpus in various ways. You can go to the next slide. And through them, we developed a long list of students who were actively pursuing graduate work and who agreed to, both in the context of their courses and also in summer experiences, contributed analytic work. These are the people who really produced the engine, which was the data sets. And it was very invigorating for us to participate with younger scholars and think about what they were going to do with this. They really are the folks who speak the digital language in a native way. And so it was exciting to see what they'll do with this material. You can go to the next slide, please, David. So how we collaborated? Well, in two forms, one virtually and the other in person. We used this software, Zoom, for periodic video conferences, both for the team that was developing the work and also for training sessions. One of the nice features of Zoom is that it has a built-in capability to make video recordings of everything that happens and audio recordings. So we're able to save these training sessions for people to be able to review how to do their work and so on. We built a website, and you can see this in the lower right of the page, which became a central hub. We did this very easily with Google Sites so that it could easily be updated. We have no development work to do for it, but in it we made shared folders, documents, links to repositories, and throughout we developed collaborative workflows of the sort that I'm sure that you each have in your own projects, with a strict version control so that we're not passing files back and forth. And then finally, the virtual culminated in two summer experiences, one a summer of analysis, and this is what the student analysts saw. They would, on the left of the screen, pull up a score into a web browser, and we'll talk about some of the technology there, which echoes some of the things we just heard in the test grade project. And then they would select notes to observe their patterns and then build using various JavaScript web forms the metadata that would go with that. And this was all very carefully documented. We can talk a little bit more about it. But maybe go to the next page. And then face-to-face meetings. There's nothing that could replace it. A lot of our work, after all, is about building community and building a next generation of scholars who would be interested to carry this forward. And so this happened in meetings at Tours and at Haverford, and then at periodic meetings of various scholarly conferences over the last several years, both in the US and in Europe. We also benefited from a series of thematic schools, which workshops held at Tours, and the crew there is very good at doing this, where you saw some of the photos, where we really spent several days not delivering papers, but digging in and learning from each other. And that was a tremendous experience. My colleague Vincent Besson, one of the editorial and technical team members, also spent a month with us in Haverford working on things. So let's turn to the next slide, please, David. So let's think about citations. What is the quotable text in the digital age? Our project is about Renaissance citations, but it's also about citations in the current space. How we quote digital texts, and then how we'll cite each other's works. It's really about building a possibility of having new kinds of credit and responsibility given for all ideas that scholars offer, even at the smallest level. Right now, our unit of scholarly credit is the article or the monograph, but especially in digital space, we need to think about giving credit for all of the small contributions that people have made to a project in the digital environment. And so we reflected on texts and citations in the past. Here is a 4th century codex in which quoted prophetic writings are indicated down the left-hand side. You can see these, thank you, David, these dipples, which look surprisingly like the angle brackets of XML, I think. Perhaps they were onto something even in the 4th century. In this way. But the quoted text is indicated in only a very general way. The dipples indicate there is some quotation in here, but it doesn't identify whose words they are, where they come from, where they begin, where they end. You can pass to the next slide, please. So here we jump to the 16th century. The world of print gives us various kinds of paratexts of the sort that we're all familiar with from objects of this period. The text here, there's a quotation. You can see the quotation marks would be met down the left-hand side of the page. But this is quite complex because, in fact, book is an anti-Lutheran text by an English bishop in which he quotes Luther, and that's the be met. But then Luther is himself quoting an edition of the Psalms, and in fact, he's quoting Hebrew, but he says, he gives his citation as the last page of a certain gathering and in a certain area of the of that page. So he's indicating a region of a particular edition. And that's a very vague way and not an interoperable or reproducible way of making a citation. Fortunately, we turn to the next image. As we heard in just the previous presentation, we have something like standardized canonical references, and the canonical text service document here gives us a reference to Book 1, Chapter 26 of the Iliad. And in the Perseus project, that reference that's highlighted in blue can be resolved as this particular space. So, what would this start to look like for music? Perhaps you could turn to the next page. We could think about musical notation in Luther's way, that is, we could talk about a particular place on a page. This happens to be an early version of an imitation mass in which a popular tune has been quoted in one voice, and we could indicate it in a target way as a region of a manuscript. But we really need something better than this, and so we could turn to the next page. This is a little frightening and not meant to be read by human beings, but this perhaps is an answer to the idea of the kind of addressable publication that we mentioned before. It's a standard called the nanopublication standard that's been devised for the sciences. and it's used to give credit to scientific work in which someone has made an observation about a particular gene or protein, and it includes in a machine-readable context an address for the citation itself, a motivation for the citation, in this case happens to be tagging or identifying, the body of the citation, in this case for us, it's a URL that points to a particular address in a musical score, and it gives certain attributes of that musical score. So these are some of the types that David was talking about. And then at the bottom of the page, you can see that there's a provenance of the claim, which is to say, who was responsible for it. And then finally, a publication where the original claim can be seen. And what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is to explain the various elements that we need to get to this kind of machine-readable individual observation. So if you go to the next slide, please, David. So we can think in the digital age of a graphical and a logical representation of the text. I'm sure this is familiar to everyone. In music, if you go to the next page, there's a slightly different problem because music itself is symbolic, and moreover, because it involves parallel streams, in the case of this polyphony, and the various metrical combinations, it can't be understood as simply a string of characters. Moreover, in scholarly editions, as you can see at the top of the red arrow, we have editorial accidentals or other notations that are added above the staff conventionally, and that musicians know to add, but that are not part of the original source. Well, in the world of MEI, which is the equivalent of TEI for music, we can indicate logically the various notes, but we can also indicate logically that that symbol has been supplied for editorial reasons. And it's the existence of this logically encoded text that allows us to address particular notes in any score, and I'd like to show you how some of that works. So we've created an API that is called the Enhancing Music Addressability API. And this is available for anyone to use. It's actually being used in the MEI community already. And essentially what it does is allows us to address, as the last speaker mentioned, for music, any notes in any measures, in any score, anywhere on the internet. So it allows us equivalent to addressing individual characters. You could think about it this way. And you can see that there's a long string. It's not meant to be read by humans. In red, that indicates the particular motive, and you can see on the score that, in fact, that motive repeats in several places. So it's the kind of thing that someone would want to be able to cite and return. And what this does is it returns the symbolic, logical encoding in MEI to any user, which then they can compute upon, or render as musical notation, or perform some other operation with it. Next slide, please. So, in order to make our project work, we also need shared vocabularies. In the world of the fine arts, people are working on Emblematica. This is the Emblematica Online project, in which they explore tens of thousands of images from the 16th through the 18th centuries, in which we have various superscripts and memorial objects that are collected together in a particular image. And what they've done is applied to the elements of each of these images vocabulary called iconoclast, which is a standard hierarchical vocabulary that comprises the natural, human, and the supernatural world. So for this particular image, you can see the half dozen tags that are associated with it. And if we went to Emblematica Online, we could see how you could jump from this image to any image that included, for example, groups of musical instruments, or art symbolism, or the magic power of music, and so on. So it's a discovery and identification system. For music, it's hard to imagine creating one enormous vocabulary like iconoclast that could cover all of music. Styles are simply too different with different combinations of instruments and voices, and even patterns. But for Renaissance counterpoint, we've created two large vocabularies, and these live in Google Slides, like the one that you're looking at right now, of hundreds of pages of examples drawn from our corpora that illustrate particular patterns. So in this case, we call this a pattern, imitative duos, in which first two voices intersect with each other to make certain sounds, and then another two voices repeat the same pattern of sounds. And you can see that this modular construction could be repeated. You could enchain several repetitions of this, and we could describe it. At the top right of the page, we describe exactly which voices, the time interval, the interval of imitation. These are all parameters. These are not derived by machines, but rather observed by human beings. And music is tricky this way because it's heard as a string of events, but in fact, there are structural tones and ornamental tones and subtle alterations that mean that the machine searching of musical notation is actually a very, very challenging computational problem. So we do this with human eyes and human ears. In addition to the musical types, we developed a large vocabulary of relationship types that tell us when pieces have been quoted, when they've been extended, when they've been compressed, all of the possible ways in which material has been changed. And this allows us to have a robust, faceted system of searching. It lets us find musical patterns and how the musical patterns have been transformed. Maybe the next slide, please. Let's see what happens. Yes, oh, one back. So one relationship in schematic form might look like this. Along the right, you can see that this relationship involves a person who made it, two targets, which is to say the model and then the mass that's derived from it, an annotation tag that tells us the kind of patterning and the kind of relationship, and then a publication URL. And you can see just by looking at the two musical examples here, even without being able to read much music, you can see the patterns in orange have been shifted in time and space. In one case, the second voice is above the first, and in the other case, the second voice is below the first. It's the same music, but it has been recombined. And this is the kind of thing that we're interested in. So if you pass to the next slide, David already... there we are. So this is one complete relationship, and David showed us this a little earlier. This is now that schematic data as represented in our website. The website is built with Django, and Django brings together, which is an open source platform, and it brings together the metadata about the relationship. This is at the top of the page, the person who made it. You can't read it, but there are many different facets that are associated with that. The model, and that renders the score, and then associates it with the metadata, and the same thing for the mass. What David showed you before is actually quite a bit of magic when we went to that particular page, because the notation that you're seeing is rendered by the browser. We don't send an image of the music through the internet, but rather we send that MEI encoded material. So what happened when he clicked that button earlier to see that one relationship was a request went back to a server at Haverford, which called upon the MEI that was at a server in Tour and that brought it back to the browser here in Paris, all in that speed. And so essentially it means that there is addressable music anywhere on the internet because anyone can call up that passage wherever they would like. It's a new means of making a quotable text for music. Maybe you could pass to the next page. Now, there are a number of things we still need with all of this work. One thing that we need would be shared ontologies. I mentioned before that it would be difficult to imagine having a shared vocabulary for all of musical creation. It would be very tough to think about how we would describe the patterns of Handel and Stravinsky and Palestrina with exactly the same vocabulary. We certainly are interested in making connections with other music scholars that have talked about this. But we do think that there could be a lot of progress made in the world of linked open data if we had shared ontologies for musical roles. And this is something where many of the common data standards like Dublin Core and others are relatively weak for things like the performing arts, because while they have roles for author and perhaps editor, roles like performer, composer, listener, analyst, commentator are not well developed. And so here from an ethnographic project is an example of the kinds of ontological relationships one might make between two musicians. And you can see them, they're quite varied. There's a pressing need for more of this work and to define in a linked open data environment what those ontologies would look like. That would make all of this work more visible. It's we turn to the next page. We also badly need tools for visualization for music. This is one that we've been working on. It's a heat map that tries to show where our patterns are, the patterns that our participants found appear in a single composition. The blue line at the bottom indicates the beginning through the end of the piece. The various colors indicate the kinds of patterns, musical patterns, or the kinds of relationships that take place between two different works. And we need tools like this so that scholars can find where other scholars have found interesting material. And that's an interesting, where can you join a conversation? And that's an important part of community building. Very often, people can search for material in these projects, but it's hard to find what someone else searched for. And we think that that's an important topic for development in all digital work, that is to how to, there might be 10 users of a project simultaneously on a given day, but how do they find each other? We turn to the next page. We have been balancing in our project both very detailed, what we'll call up close, proximate reading with distant reading. And here is a visualization using a chord diagram of the totality of relationships that we found. It's a little bit strange to look at, and maybe would make a good image on the wall perhaps someday. But essentially what happens in this diagram is that the various musical types and various relationship types are labeled around the outside edge of the circle. And then the proportion of each type that corresponds to each other type. So let's say a particular pattern, pattern A, is always quoted exactly, where pattern B is always extended. And you can see the relative populations of each of these according to the width of those colorful bars. This is not an answer to anything, but it might be the beginning of a question to examine why something is predominantly of a certain type or only rarely of another type. So that's helpful. Perhaps turn to the next page, and I have just a few more minutes left. So I'd like to say a little bit about the major accomplishments. We have created websites, tools, standards. These are all publicly available. They're all open source. There's nothing proprietary about any of the materials that we've created. And indeed, one of our great successes has been borrowing and lending to other music scholarship projects by colleagues. There's a particularly friendly group involved in the study of Renaissance music. And there's a great movement here of a kind of collective approach to dealing with many of these problems. We created many, many hundreds of analyses, dozens of high-quality scholarly editions. These are publicly available not only in quoted form, but in graphical form for people to use in performance. We've defined what we think are some good workflows and models of collaboration, both international and intergenerational. And I think as what we call here a senior scholar, I'm very happy to know that there are junior scholars who are quite interested in this new material and will continue to study Renaissance music in the next 20 to 30 years. And we've already been sharing this material in presentations and publications, both at musicology conferences and in music conferences too. Big challenges, I mentioned linked open data and music, I mentioned music analytic ontologies. Machine learning and artificial intelligence, visualizations, the pattern finding. This is a big challenge. In music, it's very difficult to teach a computer to do what a human being can do with music. Yes, the computer can find strings of characters, but music is not just a string of characters. It's a network of relationships, and it's very difficult to do this. We're looking forward to the challenge, but it's not the same as searching for strings. As sophisticated as some of the sound and semantic patterns are, that's up to the level that we do for music, but imagine that with multiple strings or voices simultaneously. We also need to connect pedagogy and research in important ways, and I think, again, this is something that we were quite excited about. We often view pedagogical applications and research materials as separate experiences, but we think that the digital environment can easily cross the two of them and show greater relevance for the research along the way. And then in the largest context, we need to think about the place of digital music notation in the larger digital world. There is an enormous body of material on what's called music information retrieval, MIR. These are the people who work with sound recordings and copyright and so on. And linking with that world is an important challenge because that world is largely done with audio recording rather than symbolic notation. And then perhaps the last page. I think the last page. Oh, yes, the next steps. We look forward to continuing this work. I'm happy to say that starting in January, I'll be in tour for a year thanks to support from the Studium organization, where I will annoy David on a weekly basis, and we will perhaps use more in-person connection rather than our digital work. But we're also going to continue work with the many TEI experts who are housed at the CESR tour. And we'll have continued study days with our colleagues in the US and Canada. We're going to apply to the Office of Digital Humanities at the NIH for one of the Digital Advancement Initiative grants. And we'll continue our collaboration with folks at McGill University. There's a very large project on music and data analysis of various kinds. It brings together international scholars. There's a new group in Europe through Daria that's devoted to digital music applications and study. And we'll be participating in various workshops and academic conferences that are noted below. I think the last slide then links well to this presentation, which you can go and revisit these slides and revisit the links that are here. But we look forward to sharing any of this information with you and are very grateful to the MSOSH and the Mellon Foundation for the activities that we've been able to sustain during the last 3 years. I will stop here.
Great. Okay.
Thank you very much. And I think we now have time for 17 minutes of questions. It could be one very long question, or it could be a series of very short questions. We could go short, short, long, short. It really depends.
Just, I want to understand exactly what you did in the project. Do you extract automatically pattern, or do you plan to extract automatically pattern from music?
We don't. In this project, we don't.
Okay.
There are other projects.
Yes. No, I know, because a very long time ago, 20 years ago, I was working on pattern extraction. It was on jazz, and so the encoding was MIDI, you know. So
yeah.
It's not MEI, sorry, at this time. But so it's possible, but it's very difficult. As you said before, yes, music is not just a string of letter. You have different level, and we use at this time some edit distance, which was in fact a linear combination of edit distance, because you have different different factors, so it was called multi edit value distance. So, but if you are interested, I can show you, because it was a PhD thesis of one of my students.
Oh, yes, certainly.
It's a very, very exciting field, and
yeah.
I'm sure that it's possible to do something there.
And really, the question of extraction information between either music notation or audio is a big challenge. I mean, there's some kind of a race between music retrieval, that is, extracting information from the audio, which is in fact even much more complicated. I mean, to filter an audio spectrum and to make it a notation is just,
especially
well, you can do it with one voice.
For polyphonic music, it's more difficult, because
even a rock band, if you want to get
the
score,
the second step,
whereas from a digital score, you create sound just pressing a button, that's it. Well, it's synthetic sound, but it's sound. The other way around is not possible. But there is a race because filtering audio is progressing too very much, and we are trying to figure out what place could the music notation still have in this world.
Yeah, just two comments on that. One of them is to remember that a music score is something like the script for a play. That is, it is an object to be interpreted. It's not the music itself. It's a representation. It's a series of instructions. And we are dealing with the instructions in the same way that the composer dealt with the instructions, that we're interested in that text. The second thing, as far as development is concerned, is that there's work underway, a subsidiary of the Peters Publication Company in Leipzig and Berlin, a project called T-Go, in which they have software that, in effect, can listen, in quotation marks or angle brackets, listen to the audio and synchronize that with an MEI-encoded score, so that essentially the computer can follow along with performance, whether it's a recorded performance or a live performance, and it's quite sophisticated in what's possible. So you can essentially play the piano and have the piano turn the pages for you as you play through it and render the music as you go. And if you slow up, it will stop where you slow up and stop where you are. So that's following the profile of music, but that's not turning the music into notation.
This was extremely interesting. Thank you very much. I wonder how much this overlaps with the quotation problem of the previous and of many other projects here, and how much one could work on unifying, homogenizing the intertextuality object, so that we will not end up with different forms of encoding. One could obviously think also of art historians, where you have one painting and another painting, or a statue that quotes another statue in quotation marks, or angular. Sorry. So I wonder how much the Nano publication, I wasn't aware of, and so I thank you very much of that. It's very useful also for people working on databases and this kind of stuff. But I wonder how much the proposition of this the object you were discussing in your group and you are dealing with here could be joined in some sense, and then also with art historians.
Well, maybe it's a question about the ontology of the well the vocabularies that we developed. In fact, on maybe we can show what the transformation vocabulary looks like. And in fact, it's very very generic. It's very simple. It's where is it?
Keep going down. One more slide. One more. Keep going. Another. You'll get there.
Yeah.
Are you going backwards?
Oh, no. I don't worry. I have it. I have it here, somewhere.
You're looking for the vocabulary.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I have it here somewhere. So that the relationships, it's that simple. And we made something very simple. So it's articulated with the description of musical types. And then we decided there were only these six possibilities to describe what was happening between the model and the mass. So it was either quotation, either transformation, either adding new material somewhere, though it's not the generic case, because you have to recognize the model, or omit something from the model. So we stick to that. But of course, we had many discussions with people working on other musical genres, saying, "Well, that's not enough. You can't describe Beethoven variations with that. It will never work, even if it's on the same theme." So yeah, expanding that kind of ontologies, even across disciplines, might be something important. But someone has to create these ontologies.
I mean, something like, in addition to TI and MEI, we would need interrelation or intertextuality or connection encoding initiative, which is covering all of our different disciplines, because this is what we will need then for training a neural network to find quotations of, I don't know, Miles Davis making fun of one of these masses, or something like that.
And just a small elaboration, if you go to the transformation non-mechanical heading on that demo, in fact, within each of these categories, you can see that there are various subcategories about the ways in which material has been manipulated. So something has been embellished, or reduced, or amplified, or truncated. These are all various terms that allow us to understand the subtle features of each one of the larger categories. So there are many sub-aspects, and you can see that there are still more when the red applies to specifically Renaissance vocabularies. We've seen some of these metrical, that is, time shifts or spatial shifts for music. And the website allows complete faceted exploration of that material. But whether that's translatable into the music handle, or as David says, Beethoven or Mahler, it's hard to say. We would need a wide variety of other categories to make that work.
Could you show mechanical, just
for context? Sorry, I wasn't able to hear that.
We're showing mechanical transformation. Mechanical. To explain. Mechanical, yeah, exchanging voices, transposing. It's just something that you would be able to do with pressing a button. Just saying, sing this, the same thing, one octave lower, or something like that.
Right.
But it's yeah, sorry, go on.
No, please.
it's the hardest thing to do. Well, not transposing, but find a new mechanical combination of something using the same material. It's saying that you take the theme of one of Bach's fugue and you write a new fugue. So that's when it's better. You look.
So what I would say is that having these various subfields and categories in the future will allow us to point to the MEI, have the various facets of what we as human analysts understand these to be, and then work with information and technology specialists to model these as artificial intelligence categories, where some mechanism could search through other music to find things that worked in the same way, but already had our subfields attached to them, if you can follow what I mean. In other words, you could find other mechanical transformations or other non-mechanical transformations based on the training set that we would develop.
My question has to do with a theoretical aspect, which is what is the unit of quotation? So when does a transformation is still a transformation and not something, a new text?
Well, that's what the nano publication, that's why it was very important. We decided there was no unit. I mean, that's what's interesting. It's the composer who says, I want to quote one note, or I want to quote 10 minutes. And so the nano publications allow you to, and even he could quote this first note and the 10 notes 1 minute later, and an analyst would say, that's what he's doing. I understood that's what he was doing. And so you could select one, or the beginning of a phrase, the end of a phrase, omitting what's in the middle. But then you have to recognize it and to make sense, showing that that's what he was doing. That's what in the introduction I said, you're in the workshop of the composer. You're trying to figure out what he was selecting in the model and doing in the new creation. The quotation can be any length. Go on.
Yeah, I would say that the answer is that we concluded that in the end, although we're interested in a ground objective truth, we're no less interested in community building. And the way the project worked, and perhaps I didn't say this, is that we had multiple students analyzing the same pieces. So every piece borrowing from scientific methods was analyzed two or three times. And the idea of that double theme or multiple analysis was that we could use it to refine the method, confirm and have a high degree of confidence when we found something that people agreed upon. But when people didn't agree, it was an opportunity for a conversation. And it's really the kind of working out of that theoretical, what is the level of quotation? What is the quotable text? Was this accidental? Was it made? Or what does it mean? That is, in fact, one of the objects of our study, is to build a consensus about what these concepts mean, because I don't think that we have defined them, even in the non-digital environment. People can't quite understand what is an illusion or what is an illusion in music. It may be that something is so much of a commonplace, and in fact, much of this music is built from commonplaces. Can you have a quotation that is also a commonplace? That's an interesting kind of a problem. That is, it's a ready-made object, can it be quoted just because it was used in another piece? And that's where the argument is, and that's where the discussion is. So I don't know that we can define it in advance. It will be up to the community to decide what some of those things.
Yeah, I think I would even extend that theoretically to a further point, which is that intertextuality cannot be defined exclusively on the basis of the text, because it is produced by the reader, by the interpreter. So intertextuality is also a function of reading, not just the function of writing. And this is, I think, this holds true for the patterns, the sound patterns you were showing in the Latin poems, or for any text. So when we try to turn intertextuality to an objective correlation between two texts, actually we are falsifying the way the community of creation and the community of culture works.
I agree.
I think we're going to have to actually hold further questions for the general discussion, which will be one of these kind of cage match wrestling things right here in the center. They're going to fill it with mud. It should be a lot of fun. And so now we're going to call up our next and final presentation. But first, we will need to thank our CRIM project presenters here heartily.